that's the plan. The definitions of law and its functions is what I'll start with. I can skip over this rather quickly because I've written up the 2 points I want to make there. There's a lot to say. So, one of the great experts on law, Hobart, an American legal anthropologist, defined law in the words that you have there. A social norm is legal if its neglect or infraction is regularly met in threat or in fact by the application of physical force by an individual or group possessing socially recognised right of so acting. As I walked in, I saw the notice saying, on no circumstances are you allowed to bring food or drink into these lecture rooms. And I thought each week I'd bring in, and I see some of you have bottles over there, so this isn't really a law. It's because it's not regularly met. We're not being objected regularly on that basis. But that's as good a definition as there is, really. And the point about it, really, is that unless you have a group or individual possessing the legal right to exercise this, you don't have law with a capital L. The point I made before. All society has laws, i.e. customs and ways of appropriate ways of doing things, but only societies with states have laws with a capital L. As regards the functions of law, Hobart again has written them down there. To identify acceptable lines of behaviour for inclusion in the culture and to penalise contradictory behaviour. To allocate authority and to determine who may legitimately apply force to maintain the legal norms. To settle trouble cases as they arise. And to redefine relationships as the conditions of life change. I've gone through that quickly, but it's written up there if you want to copy it down there. The next thing I want to talk about is how we compare legal systems. Here we face a problem which you will have encountered in anything you do in comparative work, which is there's a kind of law that the more general your attempts are, the less they will fit any particular situation. Whereas if you make them very specific and describe a particular situation, it becomes impossible to generalise, and there is a tension between them which is irresolvable. So you can either have generality or accuracy, and it's really a tension between those. In the situation, in the case of law, it's the same problem as you get in economics or religion or all the other fields of anthropology, which is that you can take what in economics is the formalist approach. You can take a legal framework, say from Western traditions, as you do in economics, and apply it around the world. But what you find is that it doesn't work in many societies. Substantivism, the actual substance and the local culture, escapes from it, and the net catches hardly anything. This is a particular problem in law, as has been pointed out in a number of books, because the West, particularly England, and other continental countries in America, have a very developed system of law. Law is very, very important and has been historically in the West from the Romans onwards. And as a result, there's been a very sophisticated, if you go down to Cambridge, down the West Road, you'll see the huge law faculty, far, far bigger than most other faculties. And this reflects a long tradition of making law the centre of your culture. As a result, it's a very sophisticated discipline. And it's very tempting, therefore, to think it must have more or less sorted out all the ways of thinking about legal processes. But when anthropologists went out with their legal training to many parts of the world, they found it didn't help them very much. For example, Bo Hannon, who's... for some reason I haven't written his name up, but I'll spell it out, he's very important. Bohannon. Bohannon writes, I consider it to be the cardinal error of ethnographic and social analysis, that is the imposing on legal ideas on others, the grossly ethnocentric practice of raising folk systems like the law designed for social action in one's own society to the status of an analytical system across all societies. And you'll find the same thing said by Simon Roberts. If you want to read one short, good introduction to legal anthropology, Simon Roberts' little book, which has been a new edition, is quite very short and interesting on law and legal process, or words to that effect. It's on the reading list anyway. How do we solve this problem? I only want to go into it briefly because I want to get onto the substance, but there have been two main ways of trying to solve this problem, how you compare legal systems. One is to make a distinction between folk systems, that is, they were called in the 60s, 70s, taking from linguistics, the difference between phonemics and phonetics. Phonemics, the ending, E-M-I-C. Anthropologists distinguish between emic analysis, that is the analysis of local particularities, which you couldn't compare, and etic or analytic systems, which allow you to compare between systems. And this is partly what Bohannon suggests, that we should strongly distinguish between folk systems, and in that he would include English legal system, American legal system, Roman law, Trobriand law, Tiv law, whatever it is, the Tiv of the people he worked with in Africa. And an analytical approach which is above that, abstracts from all those different systems some ideal type model which allows comparison. Very similar in many ways to what Edmund Leach, L-E-A-C-H, proposed in relation to kinship, that to compare kinship systems and marriage systems, you had to go up above different folk models and create a general type model. In the end, because all our language is so carrying so many meanings, like marriage, family, and so on, he suggested we used mathematical models. He was a mathematician by training. It didn't take off. No one was a good enough mathematician or even believed in the approach. But it's part of this trying to abstract up and up to a general consensus about how you would approach legal systems. There is something in it. I mean, we've got to compare, and we have to, as in all our lives, we have to try and think of how we could compare, say, Japanese, Chinese, Indian, American legal systems. But it's not really been resolved, this problem. It's just been put on one side as something we should aim at. But it's like the problems of translation between languages. It's really, we do it in practice a bit, but there are irresolvable different difficulties. The other approach is to do something which you do in many disciplines, which is if only we could find the basic psychological and social lowest denominator about human behavior in this particular field, then we could look at all different societies and see how this is carried out. So in terms of politics, you assume power maximization. That was the assumption of Leach and others, that people, all else being equal, will pursue their own individual power. The Hobbesian approach is universal. All societies, everyone can be assumed to be pursuing political power unless there's something that checks this. In economics, in formal and classical economics, it's profit maximization. In religion, it would, I suppose, be something like devotion and desire to worship some force outside yourself and to believe in such a force. In law, what do you find? Well, the suggestion is that... Have we got some whistlers amongst us, or the mobile phone? Okay. It's all got revealed about your characters by your mobile phone, so it's a good idea to turn them off. You might hear strange things. Okay, so what Gluckman, whose name is there, suggested is that the basic equivalent of a homo economicus or homo politicus is the reasonable man. Now, before you start objecting, since most of you are not men, I'll better explain what he was meaning. If you could find that all societies were guided by the concept of the reasonable man in their legal systems, then you could compare between them. He took this from the work of someone called A.P. Herbert. His book is in the Haddon. It's quite an unusual book. It's called Uncommon Law, and it's one of the great books in law. It's a very funny book indeed. He was a Member of Parliament and also a lawyer. Reformed the divorce law in England, among other things. But he wrote about difficult cases, and in his famous essay on the reasonable man at the beginning of Uncommon Law, he has a lawyer called Sir Ethelred Rutt. And Sir Ethelred Rutt is defending a lady who has been speeding up and down the Thames in a motorboat and gone past an ancient gentleman in a punt, and the punt had sunk. The gentleman had brought a case against this lady. So Ethelred Rutt is defending the lady, and he says, "The common law of England has been laboriously built about a mythical figure, the figure of the reasonable man. In the field of jurisprudence, this legendary individual occupies the place which in another science is held by the economic man, and in social and political discussions by the average or plain man. He is an ideal, a standard, the embodiment of all those qualities which we demand of the good citizen. No matter what may be the particular department of human life which falls to be considered in these courts, sooner or later we have to face the question, was this or was it not the conduct of a reasonable man? Did the defendant take such care to avoid shooting the plaintiff in the stomach as might reasonably be expected of a reasonable man? Did the plaintiff take such precautions to inform himself of the circumstances that, as any reasonable man would expect of an ordinary person having the ordinary knowledge of the habits of wild bulls when goaded with garden forks and the persistent agitation of red flags?" Now, the humorous twist is that after this long thing about how everything is about the reasonable man, he turns to the judge and said, "My lord, the defendant is a woman. She's not within the law." Now, of course, that wouldn't work for the reason that behind his Herbert's original concept is the idea that everyone is the same. You talk about in shorthand, you mean the reasonable person. There's no distinction by role or by status. The reasonable behaviour of the rich and the poor, of the policeman or the coal man, of the old person or the young person, the lord or the commoner, are meant to be the same. We are molecules, individuals, who are all meant to be reasonable in the same way. And there's not even a gender differentiation. And the purpose of the device is, in his story, the way of allocating guilt or responsibility. Now, when Gluckman took this idea to the Lozi, L-O-Z-I, and the Barotsi in East Africa, he said this was the basis of their legal system. But the system he described absolutely doesn't fit with Herbert's description. Because what he describes, he says, in the first case he describes, it did not fit behavior. He did not behave as a reasonable man would do when arbitrating in a fight. Second, his whole behavior was not that of a reasonable counselor, or Induna, I-N-D-U-N-A, following the customs of a good Induna. He says that every role or status in this society has its own reasonable precepts. So it's reasonable, in an extreme case, say, for an uncle to beat a nephew. It's not reasonable for a nephew to beat an uncle. It's reasonable for a man to beat a woman, but not a woman a man. So each piece of behaviour is status and role dependent, which is completely the opposite of Herbert. And the second great difference is that the purpose of the reasonable man concept among the Barotsi is to find out who is telling lies. It's a detective device because, for instance, in the case he gives, if a man comes back drunk, finds his wife with another man, and beats her up, and then comes into court, and she says, "Yes, he beat me up." He says, "Of course I didn't beat her up." What would a reasonably drunk husband suspecting his wife do? He's obviously lying. So it's a detective device, which is completely opposite of Herbert. And it was surprised to hear that this man, Brookman, who was a very influential anthropologist at Manchester and one of the great school, was the leading legal anthropologist in Britain for about 20, 30 years, having made this fundamental mistake, as far as I can see. But the point about this really is that what it shows is the great difference between the legal systems of the bureaucracy and in the West, and the fact that the reasonable man concept doesn't really provide a foundation. And the reason for this is interesting, and I want to now go on to. And that is that when you look at the originator of legal anthropology and legal thinking, to a large extent, the past master of Trinity Hall, Cambridge, Sir Henry Maine, M-A-I-N-E, in his Ancient Law, what he basically did was to make the same distinction as all the great sociologists and social thinkers of the later 19th century, that is Tonies, T-O-N-N-I-E-S, in his distinction between community and association, that's with a capital C and A, or Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, or Durkheim, between his distinction between mechanical and organic solidarities. The distinction is basically that in most of the societies, which, as I mentioned before, Maine had worked in India, legal systems are based on status, on who you are, where you were born, your kinship relations, your gender, your caste, etc., etc. What is odd about modernity, he thought, was that the movement, in this famous phrase, the movement of the progressive societies has hitherto been a movement from status to contract. We move from a world where you judge people on their birth to a world where you judge them on their contractual relations. He doesn't mean pieces of paper, but he meant negotiated contracts like the one I have with you to listen to me today. So this is the great shift in world history. Most societies are based on status, and a few modern societies are based on contract. This has enormous effects. Once you see that distinction, and once you see that in the diagram below, hunters and gatherers really don't come into this at all. Their lives are not really based on either status or contract. It's a mixture. You wander around in bands. Tribal societies are now embedded in status, and what keeps the legal system going is their status relationships, kinship ties, but also big men who arbitrate between people and feuding between groups. But most of the civilizations that emerged with civilization were based on birth differences, superior and inferior, and on kinship as well. Our world that you and I inhabit now is peculiar and very recent, a few hundred years at the most, and it's based, as he said, on the idea that we negotiate our relationships with each other as we grow up, and you can't differentiate people just because they happen to be a certain kin relation or a certain gender or a certain race or whatever it is. And it has immense effects. The first one I want to mention is truth and fact. In the majority of societies, the legal process is embedded, as economics is, within social life. And basically, as a result, courts and their presence are very alien. In the society I worked in the Himalayas, no one would have dreamt of going to court. You'd be beaten up by the police, you would waste money. The village was a world which sorted out its own legal problems on the basis of knowledge of the parties concerned. So when someone sat and arbitrated between different people, he or she would know the whole family history, they'd know who'd been quarrelling, and everything would come out into the court. Everything is relevant, all past history and quarrels, and then finally you'd try and arbitrate and sort it out. Because the legal system we have is a strange process in which in many ways goes against the grain of ordinary life. A court, as you know, if you've been to one, is basically a place where people behave in an odd way. They bring disputes to a complete stranger who is meant to adjudicate between them if it's a civil case, or between the Crown and them if it's a criminal case. And to say that one person is right and another person is wrong, that is unbelievable for most people in history. And if going to a court is pretty peculiar, going to an English or American style court is the most peculiar activity of all. To start with, at the beginning of a court case in England or America, you asked to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's very important to have those three things because, as you know, Blair lied about the Iraq War, not by positively telling untruths, but by not telling the whole truth. He told the truth, but not the whole truth, and he also added in some lies, so it confused the whole thing. So, by the way, I should warn you not to take anything I take as politically biased or disregard such views. I wrote to him, I told him, I warned him before he went. Now, this oath, the truth, the whole truth, and so on, is very odd, because most societies don't believe there is such a thing. What is truth, as Justine Pilate put it in the trial of Jesus? Because in most societies, there are several words for what we have one word for, truth. In the TIV, for example, there are several words for truth. Some of them mean factual truth, some mean social truth, some mean moral truth, some mean religious, mythical. So myths are true in one way, stories are true in another way, art is true in another way, and social relations. And the main point about law is that since all, when you go to court, you are part of an embedded society, it would be absolutely lunatic to tell the truth. You would be a traitor to your group, to your friends. You'd either be mad or very undependable sort of person to tell the truth in court about your family and friends. And so people are expected to lie or to tell partial truths which will favour their particular friends. So that is one consequence of an embedded situation, that truth becomes relative. An extreme form is Japan, where there is no one believes in truth in Japan. There are many, many different kinds of truths, and there's no absolute truth of any kind. Christianity and Western monotheisms tend to give us an idea that there is a truth, but in most societies this isn't very widespread. A second odd belief which we have in our legal courts is that because there is this truth, we can establish the facts about the truth. The famous de-stabilizing of this is in a film by a Japanese, the greatest Japanese filmmaker, Kurosawa, whose name I've written up there. Have any of you heard of or seen Rashomon? One. Okay, well, if you ever have a chance to see Rashomon, one of his early films, it's a wonderful, wonderful film. And basically what he does is he shows a murder through the eyes of four different people. And they each see an entirely different murder as they recount it in the court case. And it had a big effect in America and elsewhere because it showed, my wife was a magistrate and she saw this frequently in cases. She was involved in one big case where there was an armed raid on a police office in Cherry Hinton or somewhere. And the accounts of the witnesses were all totally diverse. Some of them saw a young blonde man getting out of a green car, others saw an aged black man getting out of a red car, and so on. I mean, they really believed it. So the Rashomon effect is another thing which most societies know, that people see different things. The next consequence of the distinction between status and contract is that we have in our legal systems, in theory, a belief in the assumption of equality before the law. People are on a level, not intrinsically unequal, and that I mentioned in relation to men and women, and in relation to also class, caste, race, other things. This is, and I won't emphasize it much more because I've talked about it, but basically this is unacceptable in most societies. It's thought to be very, very strange. I mean, a man is superior to a woman and therefore has rights to do things. A father is superior to a son, or a higher caste person is superior, and therefore the relationship is not equal, and someone coming in looking at it and saying, you did this to this person, you've got to know about the relationship. The spread of Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American and Western legal systems over the world has of course levelled this out a lot, but it's still, there's very large areas which don't accept that premise. Another premise they don't really accept is the assumption of individual rights. It's assumed in modern law that individuals have rights. Men, women, children, disabled people, even maybe animals in Britain and elsewhere, maybe even plants, let alone the unborn fetus. They all have rights intrinsic in themselves. Now, very few societies in the world ever even envisaged or dreamt of such an idea that you had individual rights. It's usually thought that an individual only exists as part of a group. The group is more important than the individual. He or she has rights in relationship to others. The rights are conditional on the relationship, which are inseparable from responsibilities. You don't ever have any single right without a matching responsibility. There are no innate rights which come with birth. The idea, which I've quoted before, of the American Declaration of Independence, that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are intrinsic, inalienable, and inextinguishable human rights, would be regarded by a large part of the world even today, and certainly through most of history, as an outrageous claim. To give you an example, when the British brought law legal system into India, largely as a result of Mayne's work and others at the time, it caused an absolute revolution because it had never been thought of, the idea that children there could go to court or have rights, or that women had rights and could go to court, or that lower castes could bring cases against upper castes. It was brought confusion and a lot of disapproval. But most of us believe that it's a move in the right direction properly, but it has to be taken into account that it shifts in a culture which is based on status differences. It changes the whole system very, very radically indeed. And it also requires those who bring in these legislation for individual rights to consider very carefully what they're doing to responsibilities at the same time. Because it's no good just bringing in the rights without thinking about the responsibilities. This is a tendency in atomistic, individualistic societies which is reaching its crescendo in the West, in America, and now, as you know, in this case that's going on about the Danish cartoons, where the view of the British press is that you have a right to publish these cartoons, but you have a responsibility not to publish them. The view of the French press is that rights are absolute. So there's a clash of cultures and views. To continue. The rule of law. We're constantly being exhorted by our political leaders that we should spread the rule of law. So what does this mean? I don't suppose any of you really know, or very few of you, and I certainly didn't before I got interested in lecturing on law. It comes mainly from the work of a great Victorian lawyer called Dicey, D-I-C-E-Y. He wrote a book called The Study of the Law of the Constitution. What he meant by law, the rule of law, and people take it to be, is we mean in the first place that no man is punishable or can be lawfully made to suffer in body or goods except for a distinct breach of law established in the ordinary legal manner before the ordinary courts of the land. In this sense, the rule of law is contrasted with every system of government based on the exercise by persons in authority of wide, arbitrary, or discretionary powers of constraint. So it is the absolute supremacy or predominance of regular law as opposed to the influence of arbitrary power. That is what the rule of law means. So when Tony Blair, as a lawyer, talks about the rule of law, that is the literature he is drawing on. It means that law disputes must be settled through legal channels in front of courts. The courts are ultimately the authoritative agencies of dispute settlement. In most societies, there are many others. There's fighting, there's ridicule, there's witchcraft, there's shaming, there's ostracism, withdrawal of reciprocity, as with Malinowski. But in the rule of law, if there is a serious dispute, it must be tried in a court of law. In other words, disputes must be settled by talking and not by physical force. And Dicey says, the second feature, we mean in the second place, not only that with us no man is above the law, but what is a different thing, that every man, whatever be his rank or condition, is subject to the ordinary law of the realm and amenable to the jurisdiction of the ordinary tribunals. Now just take those classic definition of the rule of law and rethink your world. Think about what Britain is now. Think about what America is now. And see whether we have a rule of law. I leave it to you. This achievement of the rule of law by the late Victorian period, E.P. Thompson, the socialist Marxist historian, rightly describes it as, seems to me a cultural achievement of universal significance. That's from Weeks and Hunters, page 265. What it leads to is the situation where people go and are tried in courts. And courts are extraordinary places. Levi-Strauss made a very, I find it always it comes to my mind, a very interesting distinction between games and rituals. What he said was that in games you start off with two exactly equal teams. If you had a football team with 24 players against a team of five, we wouldn't call it a sporting game. They must be absolutely equal, and they end up unequal. And then they shake hands. In rituals, you tend to start up unequal, but through the ritual process and the liminality and the process of the ritual, for a time you are made equal in the sight of God. Now, the legal process is very odd because it mixes those two things. You play games. It's clear that English courts, if you've been to them, and American courts, are just tennis matches, really. Basically, you have one person hitting an argument here, the other side batting back the argument, and so it goes on until finally someone appears to win and the umpire says, so-and-so won that set, that game. So it's got the essence of a game because it ends up with inequality, which is Levi-Strauss's point. One side goes to prison and the other person goes free, or whatever it is. And yet, it's very serious. You can't just shake hands and that's the end of the game. The court is now, as in a tennis court or a legal court, is now closed and everyone's back to normal life again. You take off your games clothes and continue as normal. Because everything has been changed by this, as ritual often does. Someone is going to be in prison and someone isn't. So it's a really serious game. And in order to play that serious game, you need to have elements of ritual as well. Those of you who have been to a serious court will know that it's very ritualized, very formalized. The speech is very formalized, as Maurice Bloch would say, that's B-L-O-C-H. The seating arrangement is very formalized. The judge sits high up. He wears funny costumes. All sorts of actions are taken to enforce the feeling that you are in a sort of church. And something special and sacred is happening. I think Durkheim will almost see it as a sacred space, which enforces the authority which is needed to convince people that the law is being done. So that's the peculiar nature of legal courts. Now moving on to the last point, which is a very important one. There are two main legal systems. In the modern world, inquisitorial systems and accusatorial systems. Inquisitorial systems are ones where the state in cases of breaches of state rules directly directs its power on the individual. In the French traditional system, the examining magistrate was someone who gathered all the evidence, i.e. acted as a policeman, then acted as the prosecutor, and then made the judgment. And it was the same in the Inquisition, in the Catholic Inquisition. It was the same under Stalin. These are inquisitorial systems where the state confronts the citizen directly. The miracle that occurred on this island was to develop an alternative system. It had been present over much of Europe but had died away, which is a system which puts a buffer between the state and the citizen. That buffer consists of two things. One is habeas corpus, which is the fact that you, well, it consists of three things. One is the habeas corpus, which means I have a body, and which means you must be taken to trial within 24 or 40 hours. This is why all this discussion is going on about whether you can keep people without trial for 30 days or 90 days is so important. But habeas corpus traditionally meant you had to be accused shortly after with an actual accusation and then tried within a reasonable period. And that protected people from just being thrown into jail for very long periods without any accusation against them, i.e. Belmarsh prison, traditionally, until it was Lord Lords closed it, that loophole. The second defence was torture. Torture, except for a short period in the 16th century under the Tudors, and in the Star Chamber, one court, was not allowed in English law. Recently, the ruling by the Law Lords, one of whom was a school friend of mine, Bingham, drew on this tradition to say that the use of torture in English cases, whether overseas or here, is illegal. We have not had this tradition, and we must not have this tradition. And it was illegal for various reasons, one of the most obvious of which is that you get very bad evidence from torture. It's terribly inefficient, and it's also degrading, you know, it turns the state into a monster. So the whole movement towards torture, which you're finding in America and elsewhere, Harvard lawyers suggesting that limited torture is now justified because of what's happening, is a terrible retrograde step. All of you are still living in a society where you won't be tortured here, but it's constantly being undermined. If you think I'm exaggerating this, have a look at Helena Kennedy's book, Just Law, which goes into this in some detail. And the last protection is the jury system. I don't know if you've ever really thought about it, but if you are, say, in one of Stalin's courts, you have the chief prosecutor accusing you of your things. If you have, of course, been tortured before, but you are accused and accused and accused by one person. You are against the state, the individual against the state, and the state is so much more powerful, there's no chance. In the English legal system, they maintain the jury system, which acts as a buffer, because if someone came in here and said, get out, you know, you've been defaming Tony Blair, and it was a policeman, what I would then do is to turn to you as the jury and say, do you think I was unfair? Did I express things? And you would have to decide. You might agree or you might not agree, but you're not under any threat. You are free and so on. To persuade 12 reasonable people that the state is right is an entirely different matter. So the jury system is absolutely the heart of the civil liberties. And of course, again, it's being rolled up in various cases. So Guantanamo Bay, Belmarsh Prison, all these things are signs that under the duress of war, as it always happens, we are threatened with the loss of a whole legal tradition of several hundred years. And it's up to you folks to do something about it. Thank you very much. And me as well.
Way back.